All right, good morning. Thank you, everybody, for coming. It's a big honor for B'nai Ashurim and a personal honor for myself to be able to welcome Rabbi Moshe Benovitz. First time I recall speaking here in B'nai Ashurim, but I'm a young boy, so I could be wrong, and I don't have a great memory, but it's definitely very exciting. Rabbi Benovitz, I see many people here probably do not even need to hear an introduction. But he's the managing director of NTSY, Rebbe in Reshit, was a Rebbe in MTA, in DRS, in Bruria, and most closely connected to my heart is the director of NTSY Kollel for, I asked about this, I've been told 24 years, that makes sense. All right, a little bit more, 24 plus, 25, maybe pushing 30. And he's impacted the lives of thousands of young men and women. Just anytime I get a chance to hear Rabbi Benovitz speaks, it always causes me to dig deeper, to look deeper, the insights, the analysis, the depth that exists. It's truly remarkable, and it's what has caused so many people to be drawn towards him. So not to get too cheesy here, but I was thinking as during a time when most of America is heading downstairs to open up their presents, perhaps we've been given the greatest gift of all, to hear some words of Torah from Rabbi Benovitz. So, the Chavad Gadol, I'd like to call Rabbi Benovitz to say some words of Torah.
Okay, that was too cheesy for sure. No doubt about that. So if I affirm part of what you said, I will correct some of the rest of it. This is most certainly not the first time speaking in here. In fact, that was going to be my words of introduction anyway. This is from a different aspect of our country's celebration of today. This is a very, very special time to be home. I was on a plane just this morning, arrived from Israel, and I'm far away from my current home. I have the extraordinary privilege of being able to raise my family, to live in Israel, to teach Torah in Israel, and to spend my life there. But that doesn't make it any less special when I have the opportunity to come home. And this community, this is where I grew up, this shul, and this very, very room in perhaps a different form. I don't know how many people here remember the old yellow walls and the different minyanim and learning and NCSY events that took place literally on this spot that we're standing and sitting in right now was an enormous part of my life growing up. And it's very, very special to be back here and to be back in this environment and to be connected with this very wonderful community and this very, very special Makom Torah, which nurtured me. I grew up in Rinat and B'nai Ashurim, it's meaningful to be home. I really was thinking, if I could be a little bit corny as well, I was wondering where exactly this was going to take place. And many of my fondest memories, from fooling around between Mincha and Maariv and running into the different corners, to listening to meaningful ideas of Torah, to davening in the most wonderful of environments, in this room, in the basement of the old B'nai Ashurim, on the spot that we're in right now, made a tremendous impact on me. It was one of my favorite places always, just that building. We once ran, right before they did the construction, once ran a program within NCSY that was entitled If These Walls Could Talk. Just there was a voiceover of those old yellow walls of this room describing the things that they had witnessed over the years, the things that had taken place and the decisions that had been made and the songs that had been sung, the shalashuddas that were eaten, the amzel potato kugel that was eaten, and the different things that had gone on in the room and the different things that the walls had witnessed. To this day, it's one of the most meaningful programs I've ever been a part of, and really was quite nostalgic for anybody who was there at the time. And I would be remiss if not mentioning, and again, I hate to start with something so heavy, but in the spirit of the corny introductions, this was also, and I imagine still is, the site of the legendary B'nai Ashurim Youth Minyan. And so many words of Torah in the room as it is currently constituted were offered by Rabbi David Kamenetsky Zatzal, who were still within a year of his Petira and the year of the Avelos. And to be able to share words of Torah with you from his podium and in this room is also extraordinarily special. So it's not just any other type of gathering. It's not just any other type of mourning. There's a lot of heaviness and a lot of significance and meaning involved with our being here this morning, our being able to learn here a little bit. It doesn't take away from the challenge of speaking in Yonah Dioma. This is not the easiest holiday on our calendar to be able to relate to or to share Torah perspectives on, because it's not our holiday. It's not a holiday at all for any of us. And what exactly are we going to be able to talk about that taps into that that theme of speaking about the significance of the day, if the day has so little significance to us? I considered actually continuing going down memory lane. Also, in this very room, actually, there was a lecture series in, I would have to say it was 1991 or 1992, so some 26 years ago or so. There was a lecture series given by Dr. Lewis Feldman, Zichrono Levracha, who passed away a couple of years ago. He was a legendary professor of the classics and of literature and an expert in a lot of Greek literature and the Greek lifestyle, and also an expert who lectured around the world in Jewish-Christian relationships. So it was actually, I think, a 3 or 4 part lecture series, and they hired me. They gave me money to go to Queens and pick him up from Forest Hills and to drive him here to Bnei Yeshurun when I was in YU. And it really is, without any exaggeration or embellishment, it is remarkable to me to this day that they paid me money for that, because it was the type of experience that I gladly would have paid a lot of money for. I didn't have many things to ask him, honestly. I didn't know anything about the Greek classics or Jewish-Christian relations at the time, and I was fairly certain there was going to be awkward silence on the car. How long do you ride with Lewis Feldman before it's okay to turn on the radio and listen to sports talk radio or whatever football game might have been on? I don't think there was Sunday night football at the time, but that's what I was deliberating on my way over to pick him up. But for the first time I picked him up, it was my own personal kind of Tuesdays with Maury, so I thought maybe, all right, maybe we'll just speak about the recollections that I have from those car rides and the different things he told me about Jewish-Christian relations in honor of the day. Unfortunately, I don't remember enough of them, and it didn't fill up enough of the paper, and I recall them being incredibly meaningful interactions, and many of the things that we spoke about in those car rides that had nothing to do with Jewish-Christian relations would be meaningful, but also not relevant for today at all. But that is a Bnei Yeshurun memory and a candidate, at least for what we could speak about. Fortunately or unfortunately, the significance of today has very little to do with religion. And there is a phenomenon that is taking place both in Israel and America, probably coming from two different directions that are converging onto each other a little bit. In Israel, almost like clockwork, there will be an article in the paper around this time of year of a Jewish high school, they're almost all Jewish in Israel, of course, of a Jewish high school which chooses as its theme for their senior class or something like that, any sort of Christian symbol, Christmas trees or the like. They get into the spirit that the whole world is a part of, and they celebrate, really celebrate, without any sort of meaning or Avodah Zarah implications. They celebrate Christmas in a great way, and people are aghast, and people go crazy, and rightfully so. How could it be that the Jewish state and Jewish teens and Jewish kids, that they find this exciting or cool, or they think it makes sense? And that's one kind of trend that's going on. I have heard from students from across the spectrum words that as recently as, I don't know, at least 10, 15 years ago, I never would have imagined to be able to hear. I had students who told me this week that they can't believe that they're in Israel for Christmas. They can't believe they miss Christmas so much. How can it be? You know. And I say to them, I challenge, what do you mean by that exactly? What do you miss about Christmas so much? Discussion for a different day. Is it the slate of NBA games, which are the most overrated slate of games ever, both because the matchups are not so great and also because early season NBA games are meaningless no matter who's playing and whatever. What do you miss so much? What is it that you are... Did you have a big Christmas dinner? Did you have... What? And invariably it comes down to, they'll start to say things about the spirit and everybody's so nice. I don't know, I was in Newark Airport this morning. Maybe it's because they were working. Not everybody was so nice. Not everybody is taken by all of the spirit that's there. What is it that you miss? And they'll say after a while, well, it's really the shopping. It's really kind of the sales and the spirit and the gifts. And it's a sense of plenty, a sense of materialism, a sense of consumerism, which is the defining spirit which you do not have to be a devout or believing practitioner of any other religions in order to be able to tap in. There is a sort of common ground that many of us have growing up in this society. There's a common ground that many of us have that involves connecting to what has overtaken the day more than anything else. That's not our problem, per se. If I was a minister or a pastor or a Christian theologian, I might lament the fact more about the fact that people have lost the meaning of Christmas and the essence of Christmas. They did not put that on the sign of announcing the speech. That's not what we're going to speak about right now. That's really their problem for them to worry about. The way in which it impacts Hanukkah and the way in which it impacts other days that we do care about and that are significant for the Jewish community, that might be a little bit of a different and a better thing to speak about. But what we do have to understand is that there are ways in which we can relate to some of the trends and ideas that are going on here that are not necessarily good either, but have nothing to do with Avodah Zarah. Meaning there is an inyana diyoma of the commercialization of our religious identities. There is an inyana diyoma of the shopping mall taking over, and of course the online marketplace, as was indicated in the title of today's discussion, the Amazon Prime and the Amazon.com and all of the consumerism which defines our identities in such a strong way, that is something which one need not be affiliated with any particular religion to understand the way that it is impacting us, the way it is impacting our upbringing, the way it is impacting our children. And maybe most importantly, as inyana diyoma, as things of the day, if we move beyond the insignificance for us of December 25th and whatever religion's holiday it may represent for us, if we look to this week's Haftorah, which does come many times around this time of year, we really have a very strong treatise that is describing some of those dangers, lamenting some of those pitfalls, and perhaps giving us a roadmap for how to avoid those failures and how to rise above and to create something different once again for ourselves and for our children. The Navi Yeshaya describes a certain utopian society, and he describes in a number of places in this week, Parsha Shemoses Haftorah, describes V'haya Bayomahu, grandiose language, as we'll come back to in a couple of minutes, that describes something, it will be on that great day. There will come a time and a description of a society and of a movement and of experiences that are radically different than things that we have experienced up until now. V'haya Bayomahu always connotes something of significance. What is going to happen on that great day? What is the V'haya Bayomahu? So one of the descriptions that is given in Perek of Zion, Pasuk Yudbeis of Sefer Yeshaya, V'haya Bayomahu Yachbot Hashem Mishibolas HaNahar Ad Nachal Mitzrayim. There will come a day where God will yachbot. He will do something. It's not a word that we commonly find in our language. We don't use it very, very often. We might remember it as a word that is connected to what we do with the Hoshanos when we beat them. The sitter will describe to us the act of being machbit or lachbot, the aravos. It means to hit very strongly. Yachbot. There was an NHL team called the Thrashers, and that is a word that is often used in the English translations. God will thrash. From the Shibolas Hanar Ad Nachal Mitzrayim, from sea to shining sea, God will go on some sort of rampage. Often when we learn Navi, and this will be a theme that we will describe and discuss over the next couple of minutes, often when we learn Navi, we are struck by the difficulty in understanding exactly what the Navi is trying to communicate to us. Sometimes these difficulties are explicit in it. We just had in the Haftorah of Shabbos Chanukah, the Malach appears to the Navi, he gives a message and an imagery, he asks the Navi, do you know what you're looking at? And the Navi says, honestly, I don't know what you're talking about. I don't know what any of this means. I don't know what any of this is trying to say. And even when the Navi does not explicitly describe that confusion, express that confusion, there are times where we as the reader say, okay, we're hearing something, it sounds metaphorical, it sounds poetic, but we're not sure exactly what's being said or why it's being said. There is a what and a who and a why question that are relevant to this very simple statement in Pasuk. It will come on that great day and God will thrash from sea to shining sea. God will thrash from the north to the south. What does that mean God is going to do? He is going to avenge our enemies. He is going to punish the wrongdoers amongst us. He is going to take back. That's not a word that we would necessarily and automatically associate or use in the context of end of days or any sort of redemptive process. To whom, as we just alluded to, is God going to do these things? What gets thrashed? And most importantly, why is God thrashing? Why is that the word that is used? What is being described here in the pasuk at all? If you mean that God is going to smite, another fancy biblical word, God is just going to hit our enemies. He's going to start punishing people. God is going to take no prisoners. He's not going to, everyone's going to be accountable, good or bad. Whatever you've done, we'll be accountable for the sins of what we did, and God will take retribution for anybody who has wronged him. So say that. Why do we need to invent a new word, and it is a most unusual word to describe the acts of God? Yachbot Hashem. God will start thrashing. Why, what, and to whom is this thrashing taking place? Let's hold that thought and then look to a better known V'haya Bayomahu extension, which comes in the very, very next pasuk. The Navi describes in a way that is more well known to almost all of us, V'haya Bayomahu Yitaka B'shofar Gadol. There will be a mighty shofar blast, which will of course signify ultimate redemption and kibbutz Goliath. What will happen at that time? What will take place on that worthy, great and holy and special day? That ultimate Bayomahu, that ultimate looking forward to a special time and a special day. So cue the music, we could strum the guitar, we could dim the lights. Rav Shlomo Carlebach, I believe the story goes, I wasn't there, I don't know if it's the way it happened or didn't happen, but they say shortly after 1967, Rav Shlomo Carlebach was sitting with his guitar at the Kotel Plaza, watching Jews stream towards the Kotel from all different areas and all walks of life. He was reminded of this pasuk in Yeshaya, the pasuk that we will read the Shabbos morning as the Haftorah of Parsha Shemos. V'haya bayomahu yitaka b'shofar gadol, uvo ha'ovdim me'aretz ha'ashur, v'hanidachim me'aretz Mitzrayim. Uva uhovdim. Shlomo Carlebach sang it in that song. And what will happen then after all of the people come from all of the distant lands, the ones who have been lost in Eretz Ashur, the ones who have been banished to Eretz Mitzrayim, v'hishtachavu l'Hashem b'har HaKodesh, B'Yerushalayim. One of the great and most famous refrains of B'Yerushalayim that we sing and we dance to since 1967, since Rav Shlomo Carlebach composed that particular niggun, which is so ubiquitous in our society. V'hayu b'yomahu yitaka b'shofar gadol, uvo ovdim me'aretz Ashur, v'hanidachim me'aretz Mitzrayim, v'hishtachavu l'Hashem b'har HaKodesh, B'Yerushalayim. This is a description, plain and simple, of a kibbutz Golios that is unfolding before our very eyes. This is a prophetic vision of something that we have witnessed over these past few decades of Jews coming from across the world and returning to Yerushalayim. However, there is more that is being described in these psukim, and more that is being described not just about our ultimate and final redemptive stage, but about the types of exiles and gulluses that we find ourselves in the first place. Rav Soloveitchik, in a lengthy essay in Yemei HaZikaron, analyzes these psukim and describes them in a way that is obvious to us once we hear it, both from a Tanakh perspective of understanding the psukim and from an experiential perspective of recent Jewish history. Rav Avraham Rivlin, the Mashkiach of Keren B'Yavne, recently retired from that position, and one of the foremost Israeli authors in terms of commentary on Tanakh. Rav Avraham Rivlin, attributing to various Sifrei Chassidus, he has a very similar idea that he develops even a step further. Why is there a redundancy? Why is there such poetic overflow in describing this process of kibbutz Golios? We understand that Jews will come from everywhere, enough said. Why are there ovdim me'aretz Ashur and nidachim me'aretz Mitzrayim? What's the need for that type of poetic imagery? Why are the two lands, Asher and Mitzrayim? You know, we struggle to make Tanakh, especially for our high school and pre-high school age students. We struggle to make Tanakh relevant so far. Maybe if we spoke about Assyria a little bit less often, maybe if we spoke about people coming and streaming from Egypt and from Mesopotamia less often, it would be better. We're speaking about something that, again, we see before our very eyes. So let's speak about it in more general terms and more simple terms. What do we gain by speaking about Ashur and Mitzrayim? Sure, they were the most prevalent areas. Mitzrayim, by the way, was not necessarily the most prevalent area of Jewish refugees. They were, of course, as we read in these parshios, they were an eternal rival to the state of Israel and to the Jewish people. But Mitzrayim is not necessarily the place that we would choose as the ultimate example of Jews streaming from for Kibbutz Golios. Why Ashur and why Mitzrayim specifically? And why Nidachim and Ovdim? Rav Soloveitchik explains very simply that the exiled Jew, that the incomplete, fully developed spiritual person suffers from one of two, if not both, very distinct types of maladies and opposition. There is the life of the Nidachim. Nidachim are acted upon. Nidachim are people who are banished and who are persecuted, people who are oppressed. Nidachim represents the struggles, and Rav Soloveitchik beautifully describes these struggles as not being limited to anti-Semitism and to foreign nations, but the pressures of being an observant, believing Jew, the challenges that exist in our life. Rav Soloveitchik speaks about parnassa difficulties, he speaks about tuition crises, he speaks about the challenges of raising children in a time in which that is threatened from all sides. Nidachim, a Jew who feels acted upon, a Jew who feels oppressed, a Jew who feels challenged. Rav Rivlin adds, as a matter of fact, that this must be why Mitzrayim is singled out. Mitzrayim and Ashur do not represent only two geographic poles in relationship to Eretz Yisrael and Yerushalayim, the north and the south, the northeast and the southwest. It doesn't reflect just a geographic reality, nor is it merely a historical reference to two of our greatest oppressors, the Assyrian regime and the Egyptian regime. We must be cognizant of the fact that these two names, in addition to their translations from a geopolitical perspective of Assyria and Egypt, Ashur and Mitzrayim are linguistically opposites of one another. We refer in Israel to the 3 weeks as a period of Bein HaMitzarim. Mitzrayim is a place of narrowness, of pain, and of discomfort. Nidachim me'eretz Mitzrayim. You're tired, you're wretched, you're poor. You people who have been suffering and struggling their entire lives. Certainly an apt description of so many of our ancestors, and even for ourselves, parts of our life and times of our lives, when we feel that pain, when we feel that struggle, when we feel that difficult. Nidachim me'eretz Mitzrayim. On the other side of the equation, on the other side of the fence, stands the place called Ashur. Ashur, long before it was associated with any government or regime, any country or landmass, Ashur, of course, means Ashrei Yoshvei Vesecha. It refers to the opposite of Mitzarim and of Mitzrayim. Ashur is wealth, and Ashur is plenty. The Jews of Ashur are not the Jews of oppression. They are the Jews of prosperity and of success. They are the Jews of having in their at their disposal weapons and tools, gifts and benefits that so many of their ancestors could only have dreamt about having. An immense amount of freedom, an almost unimaginable amount of prosperity. And again, many of us experience in our lives both the Ashur and the Mitzrayim Golos mentality. The exile of both trouble, the exile of Mitzrayim, and the exile of success. The exile of rampant and unchecked connection to plenty and to blessing, having so much of so many things that we hardly know what to do. There can be no better description of this exiled personality than the Ovdim, than a person who has not been banished, the person who has not been oppressed, The person who has not been challenged or acted against, but the person who is simply lost. Person who is simply confused, disoriented, unsure of the direction they are meant to go in, very clear on so many of the whats, but not having the slightest idea how to answer the whys. A person who is stuck in their own disorientation. A person who is lost. In fact, the Mefarshim, long before Rav Soloveitchik and Rav Rivlin, long before the Sifrei Chassidus, in the Mikros Gedolos, if one's look, there is a fascinating discussion and even debate about which is a worse type of term, Nidachim or Ovdim. Nidachim seems to be, especially in the way we are presenting it now, to be a much stronger type of idea. Banishment or oppression, as opposed to just being lost and confused. If my GPS or my Waze conks out and I'm wandering around New Milford for an extra few minutes and I call home and say, I don't know, I'm lost. I mean, it's not a tragedy. It's okay. If I am being banished or exiled, if I am being oppressed or challenged, that seems to be a much bigger deal. And yet, we know that when the Megillah describes to us the terrible decree to the Jews of Shushan and to the Jews of the entire Ahasuerus Empire, Lahashmid, Laharog, Ule'abed. The word to be lost does not only connote something innocent and something insignificant. The word Aveda, and it comes from the same place and describes the same individual. It refers to being lost, and it also refers to total and complete destruction and annihilation. It leapfrogs over Nidachim and very quickly becomes an even bigger challenge and an even bigger problem than the outward anti-Semitism, the outward battles and enemies that we faced in our history and continue to face to today. Uvo ha'ovdim me'eretz Ashur. There will be a time of an ingathering of those who are prosperous, doing well, excited about everything that they have, and for good reason. But they are fundamentally lost and on the verge of their own type of destruction. Uvo ovdim me'eretz Ashur, v'hanidachim me'eretz Mitzrayim. The symmetry and precision of the language of the Navi could not be clearer or more appropriate. Two different types, two different categories of Jew. One who is being acted upon, and one who is suffering from his own success. One who is a victim of his own success, and lost and disoriented as a result. In the same essay, Rav Soloveitchik has a commentary and an explanation of what we read a couple of weeks ago in Parshas Vayigash. In Parshas Vayigash, Yaakov Avinu was about to be reunited with his son Yosef, and he is fearful to the point that God has to calm him down. He has to allay his fears and says to him, Al tira, do not be afraid, Yaakov, of going down to Mitzrayim. You do not have to be afraid at all. And many of the Mefarshim ask, what is it that Yaakov is so worried about? After all, while it is true that his father Yitzchak never ventures from the holy cocoon of the land of Israel, his grandfather Avraham, and he himself has done so before. What's so bad about spending a few weeks in Mitzrayim? What's so bad about going there? And moreover, we'll get to Rav Soloveitchik's answer in a moment, but moreover, Talmidim of Rav Kook, this is not written that I know of in any of the Sfarim, but it is quoted in his name from many of his closest Talmidim. Talmidim of Rav Kook ask and enforce the question by saying that just before Yosef had given the message, the very, very loaded statement, Mitzrayim is quite good, Dad. There is lots of good. There is lots of opportunity. He uses that word. It is so very tov. And Rav Kook explains, and Rav Soloveitchik says the same exact idea. They just diverge, as I'll describe to you in a minute, in the end of the Pasuk. Rav Kook explains, and Rav Soloveitchik explains, until the moment that Yosef told him how good it was, Yaakov wasn't worried about anything at all. To go into the jungle and to come out, to vanquish an enemy, to meet a challenge, we can do that. That's okay. But start telling me how good the land is. Tell me how fat we are going to get. Tell me how distracted we are going to be. Describe to me how easy it is. The roadmap to our own destruction is not going to go through oppression. It's not going to go through our enemies. It's going to be internal. And it is going to be our own, left to our own devices, taking advantage of all that is good and wonderful in Mitzrayim. That's what concerns me the most. And Rav Soloveitchik and Rav Kook just differ fascinatingly on how to interpret. I would humbly suggest there is hardly a machlokes at all. But God responds and He says to Yaakov Avinu, don't be afraid. I will go down with you and I will bring you up as well. Rav Soloveitchik emphasizes the I will go down with you part of the consolation and the reassurance. Torah and Mesorah will be the ultimate protection. We'll come back to this in a moment or two. But Torah and our own Mesorah, if we are not alone in that journey, if we carry with us the values and the influence of our forefathers and foremothers, if we carry with us the significance and the heft of our own Jewish history, if we stay connected through Talmud Torah to the Ribono Shel Olam, we can have a radically different experience with the Tov of Mitzrayim. I will go down with you, and to Rav Soloveitchik, that is the consolation. Rav Kook, Kidarko, as is his way, of course chooses to focus on the end of the Pasuk. This is temporary, and as long as the beacon of the land of Israel, as long as there is a utopian society, a little bit less materialistic, a little bit less, and I'm not speaking about the modern state of Israel and how quickly it is hurtling towards the same type of destination as so much of the Western world. But it too retains a better sense of value and a certain aversion to rampant materialism and consumerism that plagues us all wherever we are. As long as there remains a place to which you will return, a place to which you will get recalibrated, a place to which you can plug in certain coordinates and figure out your ultimate destinations, as long as there is a promise of Ishtachavu Lashem Bahara Kodesh, you'll be okay. It's not the fact of what you're going to take down with you in the journey. It's the promise of the land of Israel and your ultimate return that will keep you strong. The more we talk about these two divergent ideas, I believe the more we will recognize that they are one and the same. And it's not my point now to go through a lengthy discussion or analysis of Rav Kook and Rav Soloveitchik and their different opinions about what the best remedies to our society and situation are. Rav Soloveitchik certainly included the role that the land of Israel plays and the role that modern Zionism could play in this discussion as part of that solution. And certainly, 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 Rav Kook did not mean Eretz Yisrael to the exclusion of the Torah that we learn and the Mesorah that we embrace as being the antidote to the problem that plagues us. But more importantly is what they agree on wholeheartedly. And what they agree on wholeheartedly is that the fear that Yaakov Avinu had was not in the evils and the horrors of Mitzrayim. It was in the goodness of Mitzrayim, in the attractiveness of Ashur. How do we go there and not get stuck? How do we survive there without being fundamentally, existentially confused? How do we keep focus when we are bombarded with so much stuff and so many things all the time? How do we retain that type of focus, that type of idealism? How do we look at one thing and think of another all of the time? You know, when the Kuzari describes Libi b'Mizrach v'ani b'Sof ha'Ma'arav, he's not just speaking about the Nidachim. He's not just speaking about the geographic exile of being in one place and being another. He's speaking about that challenge. If every ad and every commercial, if every device in my hand is promising just more and more and more of distraction, how do I ever think about something else? How do I ever imagine and look towards something else? How do I ever stay focused on anything else? How do I avoid being completely lost and totally confused? How do I ever avoid that pitfall of the Ovdim, the ones who are lost, and frankly on the verge of a form of annihilation, La'abed es kol ha'yehudim, that is so prevalent in the land of Ashur and in the land of plenty? Rav Soloveitchik quotes a Gemara that should be plastered on everyone's home regardless of where they live. This is not a nefesh b'nefesh tutorial because again, I don't think the modern state of Israel is immune from these challenges and I don't think that these solutions are impossible to find outside of the land of Israel. But this should be part of the rallying cry of our most recent Jewish experiences. The Gemara in Maseches Bava Basra, Daf Ayin Gimel Amud Beis, describes an extraordinary, I guess we'd call it a story because the Gemara calls it a story. It's clearly a parable, or at least seems to be, almost certainly, involving Rabbah Bar Bar Chana. Rabbah Bar Bar Chana says, Zimna Chada. Once upon a time, Havakazlinam Besvinasa. We were riding on a boat. Who was riding on a boat? What kind of boat? The Gemara is short on those kinds of details. The Chazinan Hu Kavra. And we saw in the middle of these stormy seas, in the middle of this tumultuous type of existence and journey, we saw an oasis. We saw a giant fish, not Yonah's fish, not the fishes that we are familiar with. There's a reference coming up to the Leviathan. We saw a giant fish that was lying on its back. And it had all sorts of beautiful meadow. Maybe it was algae or other types of growth. But they saw what appeared to be the lushest of meadows and vegetation on this island. And they were sure they had found stability. They were sure they had found paradise. They were sure that they had found salvation. They were sure they had found everything that they needed. They went on this animal, Savrinan Yavashtahi. We thought that it was dry land. Visalkinon Vafinan Ubashlinan Agabe. Very interesting language used by the Gemara. We climbed up onto this fish, not knowing that it was a fish, and we began to cook and to bake. Strange language to use for the Robinson Crusoe wannabes or these people lost at sea. Cook and bake. We began to enjoy and to have a good time. We began to recognize all of the plenty and all of the blessing. We were so excited to be there all of the time. Unfortunately, what happens? The karcham gabei isapech. And this fish gets very hot and uncomfortable from all that we are doing to it, and it can't withstand that type of behavior. It's too hot for the fish, and it does a backflip. It turns over and sends us all flying in different directions. V'ilav d'have mekavra svinasa have tavinan. And says Rabbah Bar Bar Chana, were it not for the passing ship, were it not for the boat that was nearby, we surely all would have drowned. And here is where as Soloveitchik says, let's focus on the end of the story. This is our experience so often, mistaking one thing for another, imagining ourselves to be in a place of great comfort and respite, when in fact the opposite is true, being lost in some of the directions that we are taking, not understanding which way to go. And there must be, to prevent and to stave off that type of demise, that type of annihilation, we are lucky if there is a boat passing by to rescue us. Rav Soloveitchik again argues that that boat is the weight of Jewish history, the Masorah and the heritage that we so desperately embrace, the Torah that we learn, that we accompany with us. If I didn't have that Mesilas Yesharim in my pocket, if I wasn't doing Shnai Mikra V'Echa Targum, if I didn't come to Shul Monday and Thursday and hear the Torah, we surely would have been lost in that sea. And, of course, Rav Kook says that that boat is the story of more recent Jewish history. He speaks directly of the Shoah, and he speaks of the boats of refugees heading to the shores of Haifa and Atlit, those who are coming to the land of Israel to establish something different and to save themselves from all of the tumultuous turbulence taking place outside and around all of the time. Many of my students know that I am fond of pointing out that we speak very often in all sorts of religious quests and all sorts of religious belief systems. We speak very often of the notion of Hester Panim. We speak about God's hidden face in our life and our universe. But we know, perhaps better than most, that there are two great ways in which something could be hidden in this world. If God's objective is to make it slightly harder to find Him and to recognize Him, for whatever reason that objective exists, there are two ways that he can do that. Not surprisingly, those two ways correspond exactly to our models of Nidachim and Ovdim. God, in his infinite omniscience, is clearly capable of coming up with the most magnificent of hiding places. In fact, God is in possession of the most incredible of invisibility cloaks and anything else that Harry Potter or a special effects artist could come up with. God can hide better than anyone. If he wanted to build a rock, forget about the philosophical question of God building a rock that he cannot lift. If God wanted to build a rock that is large enough for him to hide behind, he surely could. That's not a challenge, and that's one way that he can hide from us. But the best hider that we know of in this world, and he has made for his creators and for himself, if he actually existed, is a simple fellow named Waldo. Waldo, in Where's Waldo, is very, very easy to find in theory because he's never, ever hidden. You would demand your money back if you bought a Where's Waldo. You know the joke about the kid in elementary school on the blank piece of paper. Then the teacher said, what's the drawing that you made? It's a picture of a cow. Where's the cow? He's eating the grass. Where's the grass? The cow ate it. Where's the cow? The cow left already. I think I messed that one up a little bit, but you know what I'm saying. That doesn't work. You bought a Where's Waldo, and they're like, yeah, we got you. There's no Waldo on that paper. You'd be very, very upset. There's never been a publication of Where's Waldo where they do the trick. And they say, there is no more Waldo. Waldo is there all of the time. Waldo is never banished. Waldo is never hidden. Waldo is hidden because there are an abundance of things that look so much like Waldo. A scarf or a shirt, a pair of shoes or a barber's pole, anything that resembles Waldo, that our mind and our eyes are so quick to mistake for the real thing. Uvoa ovdim me eretz Ashur. There needs to be a sense of focus. There needs to be a latching onto the life preserver being thrown by that boat. As Rav Rivlin explains, what does the Navi mean in Yeshaya when he says that on that great and holy day, Yachbot Hashem, that God will go and he will thresh? It's interesting, I'm not perfect in my agriculture, but I see here that the Art Scroll does not use the word thrash, it uses the word thresh. Maybe someone could correct me if I'm wrong with what I'm about to say. I don't believe that I am. I think that that's a mistake in Art Scroll. I don't think thresh and thrash mean the same thing. I think those are two very different words. They come from the same thing. They describe similar processes, but not identical ones. To thrash, explains Rav Rivlin, is a very common, even today, and certainly in the times of the Navi, the times of the Mishnah as well, a very, very common agricultural process. How do we harvest things that are labor-intensive to harvest? And please, no immigration jokes. How do we harvest things that are very, very difficult to harvest? How do we harvest things that are very labor-intensive for us to be able to get all the time? Imagine this is the time of year in Israel, a little bit past it, of the olive harvest. What's the most economical way to harvest olives? If you pick an olive one by one, you will lose all your profits and labor costs before you even begin. In fact, it's a true fact of that Project Leket, which was begun by Teaneck residents, of course, who made Aliyah and then developed this wonderful organization of food recovery. So they will tell you that the majority, where do their fields come from? So there are basically, I've had this conversation with them many times, for those who take food for poor people from these fields as part of Project Leket, I'm sure many in the room have done that at one time or another in a trip to Israel, there are some people who are just very generous. They have fields that are there to give to other people. They're not farmers, they're just people who like orange trees, and therefore they're more than happy to give that yield and that abundance of oranges to poor people. That's one group, and there are a couple of other scenarios. But far and away, the most common scenario is that there comes a point of diminishing returns, where the labor involved in harvesting oranges, certainly olives or coffee beans or raspberries, anything like that, the labor costs involved far exceed any profit you can make, and therefore they're content to let them go and rot on the orchard and rot and fall down. And if you want to come and pick them, God bless you, you can do it. How does any society wishing to make money from the harvest of these small items, how do? They beat the tree with a stick. There are now machines that do this for you today in the land of Israel, in any place of agriculture, little like R2-D2 robots with extended arms that just jam themselves into a tree again and again. They spread out a massive canvas down below and they collect all of the things that fall off the tree. That's how they harvest those things. Says Rav Rivlin, that is exactly what the words Yachbot Hashem mean exactly. There is going to come a time when we are lost in the land of Ashur. There is going to come a time where our most fundamental connections are tested. How deeply attached are we to the things around us? How deeply connected are we to the things that are tethering us to the worst of our impulses? Are these hobbies of ours? Are these side concerns of ours? Or are these things that even when there is a knock on the door, we are incapable of responding or even hearing that there is somebody calling us? Yachbot Hashem, that's what Kibbutz Galios is going to look like. That's what the redemptive process is going to look like. Those knocks are going to come. And some people are going to say, I'm sorry, I just can't. Some people are going to say, I'm sorry, I just don't want to. And some people are going to be so connected to the world around them, so lost in the plenty and abundance that they have, that they won't even hear the knock in the first place. But others will respond the only way that the Navi prophesizes and predicts we can and we should. Others will say, we are ready. We've been ready. Yes, we were afraid to go down to Mitzrayim, but we went down Mitzrayim armed with Jewish history, armed with Torah, and armed with the promise of a redemptive time. This is not the culmination. This is not the end. This is not what we are. This is a diversion. This is a bracha. This is plenty and this is wonderful, but this is not us. I have a very clear orientation. I have a very clear focus and I know exactly what I am going to be. Uvo over the merits, Asher Bahanidacha merits, Mitzrayim, Vishtachabul Hashem Bahara Kodesh. The strength of our connection in that state of being lost. We're all lost and confused to an extent. But the strength of that being lost, the strength of that connection to the world around us, a world in which we are fully capable of extracting so much good and so much beauty from, a world which we should appreciate and thank God for having so many of the opportunities that we have, but a world that we must stop short of being completely lost and disoriented from. If the connection that we have to that world of loss, that world of disorientation, is still loose enough that when we are knocked and when we are pushed and when we are reminded of something else, we can dislodge ourselves, then the rest of the prophecy is fulfilled that God gathers us in one by one and brings us arm in arm to Yerushalayim, brings us to our ultimate destiny. But for those who are lost in the annihilation of Ovdim, who have graduated to the level of being so strong, it doesn't make a difference what happens to that tree. I'm not going anywhere. And again, I'm not speaking about Nefesh B'Nefesh or Zionism. I'm speaking about directions and perspectives. I'm speaking about a higher purpose and a goal, a sense of mission and purpose that defines our existence. Coming to shul, to daven, or to a shir on a Tuesday morning, a holiday in the workday, being able to do that out of a sense of love and enthusiasm, a sense of mission and purpose that truly defines who we are, then those are the people who are destined to have the rest of the prophecy fulfilled, and those are the beneficiaries of God's largesse and of that kibbutz galios. Yaakov Avinu was wise to be afraid. And the galus in all of its different forms and manifestations is a real thing. But so is the antidote, and so is the promise, and so is the ultimate success that we are given the roadmap for, should we choose to take it. I end with what I began with, just an incredible expression of Hakaras HaTov to the leadership of the shul and to everybody who came out this morning with so many other things to do on a day off. For us to be able to be here together in such a special place, which I know is as special to you as it is to me, and to be able to reinforce those very commitments, and to reinforce our own sense of purpose and mission, to recalibrate ourselves and to make ourselves and our chinuch that we give to our children a little bit less lost and a little bit less confused, to provide a little glimpse of light and an answer to why not a Christmas tree and why not a shopping mall and why those things could so easily be replaced by something so much more and something better. I thank you for joining me in doing that, and I thank you for listening this morning. Thank you very much.